This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Our topic today, irony. Our guest is R.J. McGill, Jr. McGill is one who celebrates irony. He says, in a culture dense with spin, it's one of the most honest things we have going. McGill is a writer and illustrator. He is the author of Chic Ironic Bitterness. McGill argues that irony, in his words, paradoxically and secretly preserves the ideals of sincerity, honesty, and authenticity. And he says, contrary to claims in the wake of the terrorist attacks of September 11th that irony was dead, irony is alive and well and needed. Alive and well, think here of the immense popularity of The Daily Show, The Colbert Report, Barat, The Onion, and as for needed, here think of last week's fake FEMA news conference on the wildfires in Southern California. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. Your telephone calls are invited for our guest, R.J. McGill. Join us with your questions and comments. The numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. R.J. McGill's work has appeared in many publications, including The Atlantic Monthly, Foreign Policy, The International Herald Tribune, and The New York Times. He earned his Ph.D. in American Studies at the University of Hamburg in Germany. Chic Ironic Bitterness is his first book. The publisher, the University of Michigan Press. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. R.J. McGill, welcome. How are you?
Good, Celeste. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Hey, how about that news conference last week?
Crazy. Totally crazy. And even more bizarre is that now we have possibly another candidate running for president.
That is bizarre. What's that all about?
Well, that's hopefully what the book tries to address, is how can someone who is a comedian, who is a satirist, be taken with more legitimacy or a hint of seriousness in our culture right now. And this is, you know, no one's really sure if Colbert is he serious, is he not serious, who is Stephen Colbert anyway, which, is it the real person or is it the character? But even the idea that it's happened before in American culture where a comedian has stepped up and run for president, but this is different. This is different. It's garnering a lot of hoopla, and it's garnering a lot of interest. And that's, I think, the interesting fact right now, is why someone like Jon Stewart can trump other news journalists for legitimacy. Mm. And when a satirist can do that, you have to look around and say, how did this actually come about? How is this happening?
Yeah. Well, Colbert is showing up in the polls in South Carolina.
Wow.
And his book, I Am America and So Can You, tops the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list this
mm-hmm.
week.
It's incredible. It's incredible. I mean, I think what's happening with Colbert and with The Daily Show and Jon Stewart and their completely brilliant writers is they're tapping into a frustration felt by a lot of people, not necessarily all Democrats either. I think there's across the board in America right now a real frustration with where things are going, with the war, with our continuing social problems. And these guys seem to be saying something honest without yelling at us about it. They seem to be on our side. And that, I think, that... so that solidarity, in a sense, is really, it seems a lot of people are reacting to that very positively and saying, hey, wait, these guys are talking about the things that I think about every day.
Yeah.
At last. someone.
Yeah. Well, I think they're so popular in part because there's a number of people have said, you know, Colbert is, you know, he is delighting in the monkey wrench effect that this possible run for president is calling up. And that delight in the monkey wrench, that's why we love watching these guys.
Yeah. And the ratings are still huge. I mean, I think Stewart is like is a million and a half a night. I'm not sure what the number is for Colbert, but it can't be far behind. That's a lot of people who are going to the show. Usually, I mean, the Pew Research Center did a bunch of studies about who watches these shows and do they get their information from these shows. And most of the people that watch the Colbert Report and the Daily Show already know a lot about the news. And they already know a lot more than people who read lots of newspapers. A lot of the viewers are younger. I think the demographic is mostly people under 35, under 40. A lot of college kids are going there. But you have to have a body of knowledge about politics and about society and how things work in the world before you can get the jokes that are on Colbert and The Daily Show. But again, what I think is most amazing is that they're able to talk about things that they think are wrong in society and in politics without hitting us over the head with them. And that's an interesting tactic, and that's where irony comes in, is very rarely do Colbert and Stewart speak in a way where words mean their literal meanings. Rather, almost everything that they say means the opposite or some variation thereof of what they're saying. But we get it. We understand what's going on. We have this interpretive apparatus set up to decipher the messages that they're sending. And that's not something they taught us how to do. That's something that happened because of the cultural situation in which we find ourselves over the last 6 years, and specifically after 9/11, where everything seems relatively satirical now.
Yeah.
It's depressing, actually.
It is. Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart it's an us and them kind of dynamic, and if you're with them, you're in trouble. And with that in mind, one of the things that you do in your book is you talk about Colbert's appearance at the 2006 White House Correspondents' Dinner. What was the Correspondents' Association thinking?
That's what I wondered a lot, and my friends and I talked about afterwards, wondering who invited this. Who invited him? Didn't they know that was going to happen? That it would be so brutal, like more brutal, I think, than anyone that could have gone on there, even if they were cursing a blue streak. What was interesting afterwards, or during the whole dinner, he went on his tirade and talked about Iraq and the president and the NSA. And the people in the room who were both journalists but also people from the Pentagon and people from the Hill were in this room and not entirely getting what was going on, and you could tell because no one was laughing. It was so awkward, I think, for Colbert. And he just kept going. He was spotless. He was perfect. The delivery was amazing, and he just kept going with his jokes. But I think it really that instance really highlighted the difference between doing this kind of social satire, doing serious critique under the guise of humor, and a room of people who were not on his side. And the president was, in the book, this was noticeably incensed. I mean, his face was turning red, and he was increasingly angry because he knew what was going on. But that event, I think, really highlighted the difference. And what happened right afterwards, what I was going to say earlier, is hardly a news network in the United States mentioned the speech. And some of the pundits came out and said it was horrible and he wasn't funny and he totally bombed and what did they even invite him for. But on iTunes, the speech, you could download the speech and it skyrocketed, you know, enormously, and so did ratings for the show right afterwards. So a lot of people really identified with what he was doing. And he walked into the lion's den and said, here's what's going on, but he never said things directly. He did it behind the guise of this persona, which has become just increasingly effective for puncturing hypocrisy and all kinds of other things that we're not too pleased about.
Yeah. Has he talked, does he ever talk on the level, publicly, about the response that he was looking for and the response that he got that evening?
I've never heard him talk about
it.
The most serious I've heard him talk was on, he did an interview with, on 60 Minutes, I think with Morley Safer, and he said that he doesn't let his children, I mean, I'm not a Colbert expert or anything, I just think that this is very interesting what's going on right now with him, but he said he doesn't let his kids watch the Colbert Report because kids can't tell the difference between an ironic performance and a serious one. So he doesn't want them, when he puts them down to bed, and they say, "I love you, Daddy," and he says, "I love you, too." But that can be really damaging for a young mind. So that's the most serious I've ever heard him talk. I mean, he had a tragic loss of his father at a young age and so forth.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's an interesting situation that there's a real possibility that he could be on a ticket. Hopefully he won't win.
Yeah, we can hope that he will treat us like his children in that respect.
Right? Exactly. We also deserve respect.
Yeah. His program and Stewart's program and other ironic figures in our time here. I mean, and I don't mean ironic figures, but people who are ironic wits.
Mm-hmm.
Are they having, as they skewer our political system and skewer our candidates, are they having an impact on the political scene?
That's a great question. I think that, yes, undoubtedly they are having an impact, mostly because irony and what the book talks about is sort of where this entire attitude came from. It wasn't always so widely shared, and I think one of the things that they're doing that's having an impact on how we interpret politics and how we interpret it, how we interpret what's going on in our culture, is they're able to take politicians off their marketing and off spin, which everyone knows they do. The funny thing is politicians often, and it's such a generalization, politicians, but the conflation of media and politics is a dangerous web. But there's a constant marketing, there's constant spin, there's speech writers that are, saying things in ways that sound either more complicated or more obscure than they actually are. And I think the one thing that these guys are doing that is affecting everybody in some positive way is saying, we don't want to hear this stuff anymore. We just want you to tell us what you believe and what you're going to do. And I guess the really odd thing is that a lot of politicians don't see themselves as doing that. But everybody knows. That's the title of a book that came out in 1999 by a political scientist named William Chalupka at Colorado State University. He wrote a book called Everybody Knows: Cynicism in America. And the point of mentioning that is that everybody does know that this goes on in politics. And these seem to be the only couple shows that are puncturing that and saying, we know what's going on, stop it. Even someone as genuine and earnest as Barack Obama, when he went on to The Daily Show, you could tell there was a level of spin to what he was saying. And that's, again, it's depressing to see that has to happen, but that's the nature of the political game in America. And these guys are our vanguard to help us, or help them, hopefully, speak a little more honestly.
Yeah. You mentioned William Chalupka, and he appears in the book. He's a political scientist, as you mentioned, and you quote him as saying, "We are a cynical society because we have good reason."
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, that's the thing. I mean, a lot of political scientists and pundits have been talking for a long time about how American society and British society also have become increasingly cynical over the last 30 years. In the United States since Watergate and since Vietnam. We know politicians are doing things that we're not supposed to know about, et cetera, but everyone has this scenario in the back of their minds. That's how things work. And Chalupka, along with a few other ones, the late Benjamin DeMott, who was an English professor, said, what else are we supposed to do? We have a justified disbelief in all the stuff that's going on. We are cynical because we have reason to be. If things were a little bit better with politics, politicians and in the general cultural atmosphere, I think that there wouldn't be such a need to resort to dark humor and jokes and bleakness if things didn't look so bleak. But they sure do. So we have to, you know, we have to find a way to defend certain values that we hold, like sincerity and authenticity and earnestness. When they're being trampled all over the place in the public sphere, we recoil into some inner place, mm-hmm. and we defend ourselves with irony and cynicism because we don't want to be taken for suckers. Because we so often are, and even from politicians that are saying, "Well, I trust in the wisdom of the American people, and the American people know what's right." Unfortunately, none of them really believe that, and it's a bad situation. And I think it's one of the things that irony and satire are doing through these various programs are enabling people to say, you know, to put their foot down and say, we're not buying your stuff and we're checking out, and this is the way that we show you that we know what you're doing. So it's a super democratic move, I think.
We've been throwing around some words now, and maybe we should back up and okay. talk about what they mean. Cynicism, sarcasm, satire, sharp-wittedness, irony, are they all in the same neighborhood?
Yes, I think they're all in the same neighborhood. They do get conflated all the time. I do it myself in the book, and also a lot of philosophical writing that went on in the 90s, some political writing, social science writing that went on in the 90s, always confused mostly irony and cynicism as the same thing. But I think there's a distinction that can be made, and I think the distinction is mainly that cynicism has given up. If you're a cynic, if you're someone who Chalupa calls it the condition of lost belief, you're someone who just has checked out of believing that anything can ever get better in our political environment or social environment. Irony, I think, is as a tool, as a mechanism of doing social criticism, always retains some kernel of hope that things can be better. And one of the ways that they'll get better is by mm-hmm. doing satire, is by, you know, again, puncturing these bubbles of pretension and arrogance and hypocrisy. It always has the future, irony always has the future in mind that we'll get somewhere else, that the reason for doing criticism is that you hope to eradicate the things that you're criticizing. Cynicism just has a resolute understanding of how things get done in the world, and it's fine with him. It doesn't really believe that things can get any better. You know, it's a depressive stance. But they also, you know, a lot of cynics will also call themselves realists, not in the political sense, but in the interpretive sense. You know, we're realistic. We see things realistically, etc. And oppositely, I think ironists are always, in some sense, are sprinkled with idealism. They say, yeah, this stuff is going on. You know, Senator X is arrested for a gay hookup, or this senator is addicted to drugs, etc. That's not a situation that we'd want to stay in. And I think ironists are doing a social good by saying this shouldn't be normal.
They're challenging. They're poking and prodding.
Yep.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, R.J. McGill, Jr., author of Chic Ironic Bitterness. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Let's talk to a listener now on line one, calling in from Champaign this afternoon. Hi.
Hi. Bill Moyers had a program with Stewart, and Stewart, I mean, if you listen to this interview, very thoughtful. I mean, it was a very in-depth, you know, he really has there's a little humor in it, but on the serious side. And quite frankly, in terms of the candidates and all this stuff, you know, potentially, if he actually became more serious, I would actually vote for him for president. So,
wow.
Anyway, I mean, both of these individuals are very bright. I mean, they're sharp. There's no question in it, you know. So anyway, that's my statement.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. Other Comments are invited, as well as questions. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Any thought on the listener's comment?
Yeah, there's an interesting, crossed my mind as he was talking, there's an interesting anecdote. About 2 years ago at the New Yorker Festival in New York City, people had shirts on, they had made T-shirts that said Stuart Colbert 08. And they were walking around, I think it was in Bryant Park, and saying, hey, you know, isn't this great? These guys might run for president. And the Washington Post reported shortly after that that they said, no, they're not going to run. This isn't going to happen. And Stewart was quoted as saying, nothing says I'm disappointed in you, my government, more than Stewart Colbert 08. And I think that's probably the most enlightening point. I mean, no doubt about it, your caller's, you know, totally on. I mean, these guys are completely brilliant. But it's also scary to think that, again, there are also honest politicians out there, and there are people that know what they're doing. And we are now seriously considering voting for comedians.
Yeah.
And it's just, even the fact that we can think about that is absurd. But as the world becomes increasingly bizarre, and this seems to be the default mechanism that we have for interpreting things.
Yeah. Well, can we go too far? Can we run too far with this? You know, thinking back to that news conference last week, there was a report on NPR where I learned about it. David Folkenflik, their media correspondent, at the end of the story, rather than go to a media expert, he interviewed himself. and it was hilarious. And the responses, if I recall correctly, to his answering his own questions, the responses began with, excellent question, David. And, you know, it's funny, but at the same time, it's kind of a sign that we're maybe all a little, I don't know.
I think it can go too far. Yeah. I mean, when it becomes so hermetic, it can definitely go too far. And a Stewart presidency would be, I think, not good. Colbert also. I mean, what these guys do is keep watch on, you know, comedy is sort of like the fifth estate now. It keeps watch on journalism, keeps watch on the three branches, and pokes out things that are not so good or that are, again, hypocritical and so forth. But these guys, I don't think you can maintain this sort of detachment or that kind of persona if you're running for president. We know that it's a joke. That's why it's interesting. We're all in on the joke. The people that like the show, that watch the show, we get it. We know what's going on. We get the references. There's a huge, you know, millions of people who are watching who know what they're talking about. But the second that it turns into something serious, you can't do that anymore, because the ground rules for playing politics are things like seriousness, earnestness, the things that irony supposedly counters. Supposedly. But when irony enters into the political sphere, you don't want politicians that you don't know if they're telling you, if you don't know if they're being serious or not. And what we vote for is ideally promises that are held. And if someone is constantly in a performance mode, it's just conceptually impossible to think about what they might do or not do. Are they serious? Are they not serious? Serious in the sense that consequences will follow from the things that they say. Colbert was speaking with, there was an interview, and he was saying, you know, when I'm on my show, I don't ask people to believe what I say. I just hope that they laugh at what I say, but that doesn't mean that I don't believe it. And that's sort of where he is. I mean, speaking in tongues, almost.
He's the trickster.
He's the He's the one who goes and honks the nose of the king. Yeah. You know, in medieval plays, he can go up and say, "Boink! I can tell you the truth, yeah. But I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do it in a way that is joking, that is entertaining, that's funny. But it doesn't mean it's not serious. And I think now, because of the reception of both of these shows and their widening media influence and empire almost, I think it's one of the most serious things going on, and that's why it's strange when "quote unquote" serious media outlets are not paying attention to these guys as much as they should be. They're doing some of the most trenchant politics and political critique that we have going on. I mean, certainly more than some dry journals that no one reads.
Well, speaking of seriousness and the work of ironists, you mentioned in the book Doug Marlette, the political cartoonist, and his writing in the wake of riots over cartoons. He had no cartoon today because the world had become a cartoon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a whole other field that has been doing this kind of work for a long time. That's quick aside, that's my other sort of engagement. I'm also a political cartoonist for a magazine called The American Interest in Washington. That's an entire other field of where satire and irony have been doing their jobs for centuries now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about cartooning. Tell us about the illustrations you did for this book, and I'm going to give folks sort of how the titles as they appear in Chic Ironic Bitterness. Karl Marx as the talk show host, Stephen Colbert with heart, Socrates with Game Boy. When did you begin drawing cartoons, these illustrations? I guess I don't know if they're quite cartoons.
Yeah, I think they're little caricatures of various philosophers and thinkers. I've been drawing forever and did a degree in painting and drawing a while ago. It just seemed the backstory is the book began as a dissertation about romantic irony and civic trust in America and how they sort of rub against each other with tension. When the dissertation was done, I wanted people to read it and not to go sit on some library shelf somewhere. I thought that the topic was relevant, was increasingly relevant after 9/11, and in the years following, it just snowballed. It seems that there's satire popping up everywhere. On Jeopardy, for example, the Serious Jeopardy show, there's a category now from The Onion. Spiegel magazine in Germany has a satire component on its site. Newsline with Ted Koppel took up a half an hour talking about South Park's 10th year anniversary. So it became increasingly, the stuff seemed to be increasingly relevant. So in order that the book could play a part in a wider readership and not be simply an academic review of things that were going on and you know, ruin great television with analytical thinking, I thought it would be great to spice it up with some funny drawings, as well as call-outs, like a magazine has the big, bigger sentences that call out important points. And that was a discussion with the University of Michigan Press, and they were happy with it, and we just moved forward. And I think there are 21 drawings, and mostly they're all older figures, older philosophers, but some of the more contemporary people are, like you mentioned, Colbert and the political scientist Robert Putnam is in there playing a banjo because he has a very funny beard.
Well, now tell us about the title, Chic Ironic Bitterness. What does it mean exactly? What inspired it? What's its significance?
I mentioned this in the preface. The original phrase, Chic Bitterness, or Chic Bitterness, appeared in a book by a German philosopher named Peter Sloterdijk, who's a big deal in Germany still and an exceedingly great, a really brilliant philosopher, wrote a book called The Critique of Cynical Reason, which came out in 1983. And he used that phrase, Chic Bitterness, to describe the cynics inhabiting late industrial modern society, he was observing Germany, but you could transfer it easily, depressives who know the way social reality works and find it dark and frightening, but go on nonetheless. You have to keep working, you have to keep plugging along. There is a giant system in place of how things they respond instead of with a giant social revolution, a certain chic bitterness that enables them to not feel like these pressures and these catastrophes that are going on are actually happening to them. It gives them a certain distance. So I took that, took his phrase, and inserted the ironic part, because I think that's the method of how we've been doing it for the last little while.
Let's take another call now. Listener in Mahomet on line one. Hello.
Good afternoon. I'm enjoying the show immensely, and it brings up lots of comments. I first wanted to ask your guest where he would place Bill Maher in this sort of spectrum of shows.
I think Bill Maher's very funny.
Yeah.
I think he's incredibly smart and knows his politics back and forth. I don't think he has he doesn't enact the persona that Stewart and Colbert do. I think when he criticizes and lambastes and goes after people, I think he does it a little more directly, still with jokes, but
yes,
without the wry.
He has the sense that, I agree, that he's very bright and very funny, but that he has an agenda.
He's undoubtedly a liberal. Yeah, he's definitely explicit.
Right.
About that and is very clear, and I think that's a great point. I mean, I think he's, you can see that, and he doesn't hide it.
Right.
Colbert and Stewart, they're less after political goals than they are after moral ones.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's the big...
Which elevates them to a certain degree.
Yeah, for sure, because you don't know... Because they go after both sides, and I think as Americans...
The saddest thing I've heard come out of this show, though, is, and it's true, is the statement that why would we vote for someone who's smart when we can vote for an idiot? I mean, and the compromises that one has to make as to be a politician.
Yeah.
And most people who are intelligent and humane and I won't use the word liberal because that's got bad connotations, but people who think wouldn't last in that world.
Yeah, I think it's really hard for someone with, it's Mr. Smith goes to Washington all over again. I think you have people with very good intentions and very clear ideas of what they want to do politically and socially, what they see as social injustices, what they see as would be a better situation for civic trust in America. But you go in and you get swept up into this maelstrom of the political game. And again, I think as regular citizens, you and I and our listeners, we know that goes on. And
we know that when people say something political, make a promise or take a stand on some issue, that's not likely to hold any water, if they do indeed get elected.
Yeah.
It's a kind of either cynicism or. That's the cynicism, I suppose.
Or just observation.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, sorry.
What's the name of the book again?
It's called Chic, Ironic, Bitterness.
Wonderful. Well, I've enjoyed the show immensely. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for calling.
Bye-bye. This afternoon. It's almost like the politicians, it's a conceit between us and them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for sure. And it's disturbing. Again, it would be different if we were all idiots. And we would say, you guys are great, and, we don't know you're lying to us. But, and again, I know, we're speaking this afternoon in massive generalizations about politicians
right.
and Americans and who are these people, et cetera. But I think there are a few, deductions you can make from the way many politicians have behaved. I mean, these people are supposed to be representing us on the world stage in some sense. They're also supposed to be standing for models of what counts as moral behavior. And I think there's a disconnect increasingly, again, the growth of cynicism and wry, ironic detachment from political leaders has been going on for 35 years. And civic trust has declined in all studies drastically in the same time. So one has replaced the other. But I still think that we long, or at least large portions of people who aren't, down and out and sort of shut out of the political game, long for a return to something better, some kind of social social hope or some kind of vision of America in the world that doesn't embarrass them. Mm-hmm. And again, I think you can get that on both sides of the political aisle, that things are wrong in Washington. And, you know, there are certain ways to go at it, but I think a big way that we see as a daily affirmation of our ability to think for ourselves and to make judgments is this detachment, is this automatic mm-hmm. knee-jerk not believing what politicians tell you. And that's, again, that's just a very sad state of affairs when most of your citizens know that you won't tell them the truth. Mm. And, you know, I'm sure there are a million ways we can get back on track, and we're also responsible in our communities, et cetera. But, there, you know, the guys that are running the country have to also behave themselves. And, again, a lot of them do. I know that's true. But they have to realize that people look to leadership for, you know, for moral standards, for moral behavior, and when again and again it happens, you think, yep, same stuff.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another listener, a listener in Urbana. Line 2, hi.
Back to the comment that Celeste made about this guy ending a report and interviewing himself.
Mm-hmm.
The point of that whole thing was about the FEMA, the FEMA press briefing, where they gave the network 15 minutes and nobody particularly got there, and every single question was asked by a FEMA personnel who were posing as reporters. So
exactly.
So much for
heck of a job, FEMA.
Again.
So, yeah, you know. And I want to thank the listener for calling in, and you know, there are undoubtedly some folks that missed the story.
Yeah.
As well. So thanks for the call. And
thank you for that.
And, you know, telling us what it was all about there.
Yeah.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. We have a few minutes left remaining in this portion of the program. Our guest this afternoon, R.J. McGill, Jr., author of Chic Ironic Bitterness. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to join us with a question, with a comment, give us a call, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with another listener on a cell phone in Urbana. Line 1, hi.
Hi. I was just reading an article in Time magazine about 20-somethings in China who are totally uninvolved in politics and not striving for democracy or caught up in any of the things that their predecessors were. But it almost puts them in the same mental state as a lot of people in this country who feel like, you know, what is the point of caring about who's elected when it doesn't make any difference?
That's a great, great point. And there are a lot of interesting studies. The book that I had mentioned earlier, this Critique of Cynical Reason, studies the mindset of the Weimar Republic between the World Wars and Germany. And the people had the exact same attitude, was checked out, not caring, what does it matter if I do anything anyway? And the fact that those things look like each other, like young 20-somethings in China run by a dictatorship in a communist country where there are no the sort of the liberal freedoms we enjoy, when those mindsets look like each other, that's scary. That's scary. So
I think so. I agree. I think it's very scary.
Yeah.
But all I have is questions, no answers. So
yeah, same. Same. It's but we're asking. I think that's how things get started. Is you recognize the problem first, and then, you know, it'll take a little while, I think. But I think recognizing the problem, like some of these shows are helping us do, is a good first step. I mean, it's definitely not apathetic.
Hmm. This book came out of your dissertation.
I'm wondering, going back in time, when and how was it that you began thinking about the value of irony? Earlier in the program, in my introduction, I mentioned, you know, after September 11th, people said the age of irony is over. What were your thoughts about that commentary at the time, and when and how was it that you began to formulate this idea for your dissertation, the value of irony?
Mm-hmm. There are two episodes, I guess, that helped germinate the whole thing. And one was in 1999, this Chalupka professor who I mentioned earlier, and a young law professor who's at Duke right now, Jedediah Purdy, he had written a book called For Common Things, and it was about irony among his generation of fellow students at Harvard, and that came out in 99 also. And what was interesting, after the Purdy book came out, the poor guy was absolutely destroyed in all kinds of magazines for being overly earnest, for, you know, not understanding how the world works. Some people thought he wasn't even a real person because they hated the book so much. But the reaction seemed to really outweigh the comments that he was making in the book. So I wondered, just at that point, like, why are people freaking out so much about irony? It's supposedly just a literary trope. And some people were, you know, yelled at Purdy for saying, you're using the word wrong, it just means what it's always meant, which is when the meanings mean something other than the words say, etc. This is what a literary trope of irony is. And he was going after something a little bigger. But like I said, he was just excoriated all over the place, and it was interesting that happened. That was one thing. So I wanted to look into why exactly the poor guy was getting, you know, raked all over the place. Mm-hmm. And secondly, like you said, after 9/11, you know, this absolutely unimaginable tragedy befalls the country, and four or five, at least, prominent political pundits, among them Phil Klore, James Pinkerton, and then the esteemed civil rights historian Taylor Branch, as well as Graydon Carter at Vanity Fair, all said, this day spells the end of the age of irony. And from now on, it's all seriousness all the time. It's all patriotism. It's all renewed civic union, etc. And that lasted about 3 weeks, because then 3 weeks later, Giuliani went on Saturday Night Live after a skit about, giant diapers or something, and said New York City was open for business and the work of the nation could continue. It's interesting that he said that on Saturday Night Live when irony was supposed to be dead and gone. Mm. And what happened shortly after that, one question that came up was, why after, it was a very innocent sort of question, why after these horrendous attacks and the cold, you know, a sort of general fear that was spreading around, why were people going after irony? It seemed like the most random target. And what I found in doing research, mostly in reading philosophers and over the past, you know, several hundred years, that irony had garnered a very negative spin morally from the beginning. It did used to be a literary trope, starting with the Greeks, and that was it, but it denoted a sort of lying or sly foxery was a favorite word. Aristotle, for example, thought that moral people that were truly moral, that were good citizens, were not ironic. They didn't need it. That being ironic was a sort of character flaw. And the valuation of irony changes over the history of writings about it until, and I'll finish this comment in a second, until about the end of the 18th century, where people start valuing it as a good attitude to have that keeps you at a distance from things that are otherwise messy or that threaten your own integrity. And that change in valuation is what I found to be, that was the interesting turning point.
Mm. That, I think, also goes to your, at the bottom of this, the tension between romanticism and civic trust. Irony allows us breathing room in
yeah.
there.
That's right. And the romantic irony, I mean, it sounds like a fancy word, and all it really designates is a point in our cultural history, in Western cultural history, where the ideas of how we know the world become very messy, and there's no clear standards for morality, for beauty, for truth. This all happens at the end of the 18th century, and I think in some sense, it's also called modernity. They're replaceable terms, and we're still dealing with that. What counts as good art? What counts as being a good person? These things were relatively clear up until the end of the 18th century, when things started to both become much better in terms of individual freedom, but also much more disturbing in the sense of there being no clear rules anymore for how society should work. So that's where we live in the wake of that time, and we try to navigate our duties as citizens, but also our own integrity, that we can't be blind believers in political leaders because we'd be complete idiots and taken advantage of. So we have these dual mindsets, and I think that's where we are as a culture now, is trying to navigate through these two things, to hold on to our integrity and these other ultimately religious values that we have in our culture, but also not be taken advantage of.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time.
Okay.
R.J. McGill, Jr., thank you very much.
Thank you, Celeste. I really enjoyed it.
R.J. McGill, Jr. is the author of Chic Ironic Bitterness, the publisher of the University of Michigan Press. Our guest is on the web. The easiest thing to do, I think, would just be to put his name into your browser, R.J.J.A.Y. McGill with two L's, Jr., Chic Ironic Bitterness.